Hello and welcome again to another episode of our Bitcoin, Fiat and Rock'n'Roll podcast, the BFFR podcast that explores the intersection of blockchain, crypto and the traditional financial sector and helps you to explore and navigate the developments in digital assets and digital money. And today it's me again, Manuel, and I have a very special and interesting guest today again, which is Rod Garrett. And Rod Garrett might be known to many of you as one of the advisors at the BIS, but he has had many different roles. So I'm very glad, Rod, that you joined us today for an overview on digital money. Hi, Rod.
Hi, Manuel. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, thanks a lot. So yeah, Rod, before directly diving into each of the different four digital forms of money that we want to touch today, let me give a quick download of your bio, which is quite impressive, but then also hand over to you for your rundown, how you actually also got to this new development of digital money. So you are a professor at the University of California in Santa Barbara, but most recently you've worked as a senior advisor at the BIS, at the Bank for International Settlements, but you've also had stages at the Bank of England and at the New York Fed, where you also ran interesting projects there. So for example, Project Jasper, which was a very early proof of concept in wholesale central bank digital currencies or tokenized central bank money, how it is also nowadays referred to. Phase one and two, which was groundbreaking because it was quite early, right? So 2015 to 2017. Let us know, maybe, what was your journey on that regard. How come that you're then focused on digital money, and in particular at the beginning at central bank cryptocurrencies, as you coined them back then? Yeah?
Sure. Well, thank you for that introduction. So my interest in crypto began actually when I was still at the New York Fed back in 2013, when the price of Bitcoin shot up to $1,000, which seemed astronomical at the time. And it was quite remarkable, actually. If you think about it, it's more impressive to go from zero to 1,000 than it is to go from 1,000 to 100,000, because it's that initial, the ability to suddenly gain value that really is remarkable. And so Bitcoin shot to $1,000, and I was at the New York Fed, and people around the Fed started saying, what's Bitcoin? So again, this is 2013. So we started something called the Virtual Currency Working Group. And I ended up co-leading this group for the Federal Reserve System with a member from the Federal Reserve Board in Washington. And we put together a group that included members from all of the Federal Reserve banks and the board. And we met weekly to try and at first figure out what Bitcoin was, and then start reporting to the leadership on what Bitcoin was so that they could answer questions and so on. And then ultimately to coordinate research. And so this was my introduction. I was in the money and payments division at the New York Fed. And so it was natural for me to take on this role. And this is where I got started working with crypto. It was quite an interesting time. There was a Bitcoin office that was opened right near Wall Street. And I used to walk down there and ask them questions. And I learned a lot. And so that was my introduction to Bitcoin. So then I actually left the New York Fed and started working with the Bank of Canada. As you said, I've traveled around a little bit. And that's where I started to do Project Jasper. So the idea there was quite simply that, you know, in some ways, the initial reaction to Bitcoin was, well, we're not so sure about Bitcoin, but we find the technology interesting. And so a lot of banks, well, at that time, sorry, not a lot of banks, it soon became a lot of banks. But at this point, the Bank of Canada said, well, maybe we can use this technology to improve the way we do wholesale payments. And by the way, that's really what my experience was before moving to the New York Fed. I've been a longtime payments economist dealing largely with wholesale payments. So there was a natural fit there and combined interest in thinking about combining, you know, distributed ledger or blockchain technologies, and ask, could those technologies be used to improve wholesale payments? And that's what Project Jasper was. And as you alluded to, that was in some ways the start of many, many projects of that type. So that was my introduction.
So interesting that 2013, I mean, this was also my entry into Bitcoin. I was still at university in an FX class. We had like a trading game and they gave us funny money on plus 500. And I discovered this weird Bitcoin thing. Overnight or over a couple of nights, I was by far on the first place. And then a couple of days later on the very last, because I did not get to exit this crypto bull run. And yeah, this was also my introduction in the topic. Quite interesting that this was also on your side, and quite early, actually, right? Impressive that also the Fed has already started to look or at least to monitor the developments in this space. When thinking about Project Jasper, could you distinguish between the different types of digital money that we're currently seeing, right? Because we have digital money on all fronts, right? Project Jasper, as you said, was rather on the wholesale side, so on the interbank side. So is this what you would now call wholesale CBDC or tokenized central bank money? And how does that differ maybe from other projects that other banks or central banks focus on, which is more on the retail side?
Yeah, so I think the initial interest in using this technology was on the wholesale side. And so Project Jasper was about doing interbank payments using distributed ledger technology. So it would be, you know, a substitute, if you would, for the large value transfer system. And early on, one of the interesting questions was, how should the central bank do this? And there were really two obvious choices. One was that the bank could simply create a token and declare that this is central bank money. So there'd be essentially three forms of base money. There would have been cash, conventional reserves, and CBDC. It was very quickly decided that that was legally too complex, and that a much easier way to implement this proof of concept was to use this digital depository receipt model. So that is, create a token which points to reserves held on the balance sheet of the Bank of Canada. Now, interestingly, the Bank of Canada can hold its own reserves. That's something that the US, that can't be done in the US, but the Bank of Canada can hold its own reserves. So in the proof of concept, the commercial banks could send reserves to an account that's held by the Bank of Canada, and then the Bank of Canada could issue tokens in value equal to the amount that's held in that account. Those tokens could trade throughout the day to make payments, and then at the end of the day, all of those tokens were cashed. So the idea is that it would only exist during the day, so it wouldn't have overnight implications, and that was the model. And so initially, that was done on Ethereum, so on an Ethereum testnet, and you know, we looked at that situation. Of course, as implemented back then, it didn't meet all of the user requirements, privacy being one of them. And so then we evolved to using a different type of distributed ledger platform that was provided by R3, a predecessor of Corda. And then we went from there. But that was the initial idea. So right off the bat, there was this interesting idea of whether or not we would use a new form of central bank money or instead this idea of a depository receipt. And I think this depository receipt model has also been replicated many times since.
Yeah, it sounds a bit familiar to the Finality model, even though it's a private organization that then provides those tokens, or however you want to call it, right? So locks them.
And predates the Finality model.
Yeah, that's true, actually. Yeah, the utility settlement coin, I think that was the initial name of it, right? And I also spotted that particular way of representing central bank money on a blockchain in a paper that you then in 2017 wrote, right, which is called or coined also central bank cryptocurrencies. The research was very much still in the infancy and very young, right? So this term central bank digital currencies has not existed yet back then. You called it CBCCs and not CBDCs. At that time, most central banks, at least from my point of view, and at least from external research and external publications, haven't really started to look into CBDCs, especially retail CBDCs. And then one of the main contributions was your money flower, right? That really helped to explain the different types of money that exists and where CBDCs actually fit in, because it was such a new concept that many couldn't really get their head around it. And at the heart was also the distinction between retail and wholesale CBDC, I think, right? And other private and public forms of money. You know, the research then started also to allow at least also the thoughts into a retail version of central bank digital currency, where I remember very well, for example, Jens Weidmann from the Bundesbank. He was a strong opponent of CBDCs back then in the day, right? How was the reaction initially when you brought up this research and actually also explained how central banks could provide retail digital forms of money, basically like a digital form of physical cash, right? Which now some banks are following, other or central banks are following, others have gone away again. But the predominant central bank that is now looking into it, I would say, is the ECB with the Digital Euro Project, right? So how is that journey also on the retail side?
Wow, so there's a lot there. Let me just back up a little bit and talk about what the impetus was for this paper called Central Bank Cryptocurrencies. And so remember, the BIS is a service organization, and I was working as a technical advisor at the BIS at the time. And so Morten Beck and I, we were asked to sort of explain what was going on with these various different types of concepts for central bank digital currency. And a little bit more backdrop in tying this into Jasper. One of the things that Jasper did initially on is we used this phrase called CADcoin. And so CADcoin was going to be the name of the central bank digital currency, but then that became a little bit too charged, I guess. And so that name very quickly got dropped. But there was also at the time, if you recall, there was a very famous blog by J.P. Koning where he introduced this idea called FedCoin. And so FedCoin was an idea for a government-issued stablecoin, essentially, that would provide sort of a version of Bitcoin that had stable value. And so there was a lot of confusion at the time between FedCoin and CADcoin, not necessarily by those names, but by the concepts. And so what we were trying to do in this article was not advocate for CBDC necessarily, but just to explain to BIS membership and all the private banks how to think about these different currencies. Again, remember, we're going back to, I think, February of 2017. And so we decided to do this by thinking in terms of these four characteristics, which ended up being quite useful. So universally accessible, or not? Is it electronic or not? Is it central bank issued? And is it peer-to-peer? And just a quick side story. We wanted to present these four characteristics in a Venn diagram. There's actually a paper by John Venn from 1880 that explains all this. But if you want a diagram for N characteristics, then it has to show two to the N distinct non-overlapping regions. So if you want four characteristics, you need 16 regions. This is in order to show all the different elements and combinations and their complements. And so in two dimensions, if you use circles, you can only show 14 regions. And so you have to move to ellipses. And this is how you end up with this shape that looks like a flower. So when, of course, we did this, we ended up calling it the money flower. So we produced the money flower, and this ended up, I think, being very useful. As you know, it was circulated a lot, but it was able to position all of the different types of money in terms of commodity monies, deposits, virtual currencies like Bitcoin, stable coins, you name it. And it also it clarified the distinction between, say, central bank digital currency, which of course reserves would, or settlement balances, I guess, in Europe would be qualified as, and say CBDC or cryptocurrencies, which would, you know, the distinction there would be whether or not they're transferred over peer-to-peer platform. So that was the sort of purpose of them in Money Flower. It really wasn't to advocate. So, you know, of course, there'd be discussions on whether or not we should have cryptocurrency or central bank digital currencies. And by the way, we have to use the name central bank cryptocurrency because the BIS report that came out very shortly after, which we also contributed to and also contained the money flower, was going to be called central bank digital currencies. So that's a little backstory there. But that was the origin of that. It wasn't designed to advocate. It was just designed to explain. And at the time, as I mentioned, much of the interest was on the wholesale side and thinking about using central bank, you know, cryptocurrencies to enhance financial market infrastructures. And, you know, there wasn't that much interest in the time on the retail side. And remember, actually, if you go back, when you think about, you know, central bank, whether or not, you know, central bank, you know, if you think of the money flower, you know, one of the ideas is widely accessible, central bank issued and widely accessible. Well, central bank reserves are central bank issued, but they're not widely accessible because you're not allowed to have a bank account at the central bank. And so, you know, this idea of having like deposited currency accounts was actually a relatively old idea that's been debated for years. And so the money flower just put that in context so we could think about just having deposited currency accounts, that is letting individuals hold accounts at the central bank. We could have banks hold accounts at the central banks, but these be sort of conventional accounts, or we could think about doing both of those things, but doing them on, say, a peer-to-peer or a distributed ledger platform. And that introduces the idea of retail CBDC and wholesale CBDC. So initially there was interest in wholesale CBDC, but then, you know, what happened was Facebook's Libra. And then all of a sudden, there was this idea that, you know, that the private sector was going to introduce some type of global currency. And this really spurred interest among central banks in digging deeper into the idea of thinking about retail CBDC. And there was, you know, a lot of thinking that, you know, went into that. And back in 2018, I testified before the Subcommittee on Monetary Policy and Trade in the U.S. House of Representatives on this exact question. So in a session on the future of money, digital currency. And the basic question was, should we have essentially a retail CBDC? So that idea has been debated, you know, for years. And, you know, we could talk about that debate and what the pros and cons are. But of course, the way it turned out, that ultimately became rather a politically charged issue. And most developed countries have backed away from this idea. And Europe, of course, being the exception.
Yeah, and it's been a wild ride, I would say, over the last years when it comes to CBDCs, right? As you said, so many central banks have done pilots or proof of concepts on the wholesale side. Some have spearheaded the development on retail CBDCs, predominantly smaller, yeah, maybe you could argue developing countries. That is all also focused on blockchain, right? Whereas I would say other developed countries have now rather taken a different stance where it's not necessarily about using blockchain technology, but rather for other reasons, right? So for example, the usage of cash is declining and therefore central banks might have an interest to still provide public forms of money to the retail user or to the citizens. Whereas if they hold bank account money, so bank deposits or electronic money, as we have in Europe, this is a private form of money, right? Private form of fiat money and not necessarily the public form. So that was one reason. And then as you also say, the political aspect, right? So I'd be interested also to hear your views on the Eurozone, because we're looking at that from various angles and the ECB obviously as well. But I think one of the predominant reasons is also the sovereignty of payment systems that has come up now over the last years, right? Where the ECB says we need a pan-European payment system that so far doesn't exist. We have national payment systems that are not interoperable and you cannot use them without, for example, a card-based payment, without a co-badge of Visa or MasterCard, right? And therefore also this political aspect came into play. What's your view currently on maybe doubling or double-clicking on retail central bank digital currencies, on the adoption in the world and also the projection? Because yes, the BIS does all these surveys, right? Only recently there was the recent survey of 2024 coming out, where it's still shown that most central banks are looking into it. But I feel that the trend of really adopting new technologies for providing retail CBDCs, so central bank digital currency for the end user, is not continuing. Let's put it this way, right? Where the ECB is rather going on its own in comparison to others. We have India and we have China, but the success of those has so far also not taken off, right? So long question again. The bottom line, basically, retail CBDCs. What's your view on the current path forward?
Well, again, I think what happened on the retail side is initially, early on, sort of in 2018-19 and so on, there was actually a debate in thinking about retail CBDC, whether or not it should be essentially blockchain-based or not. And again, the not arguments, the sort of idea of it just being giving central bank access to, or the public access to central bank balance sheet, or giving them central bank accounts, that goes back to James Tobin in the 80s. And so that's been debated forever. And then I think the most interesting development is again, after Libra, is it pivoted towards, well, if we do it, we would probably do it in a DLT way. So, and why? Well, programmability, you know, so starting to talk about leveraging the advantages of distributed systems, much like we talked about doing this on the wholesale side. And so the debate started to be on that, along those lines. So these ideas of thinking about leveraging things like programmability, and also possibly things like privacy, which is, you know, I want to come back to that and talk, because that's an area that I've worked on a lot. But sticking on the programmability idea, this is probably the best use case to explain what sort of happened in terms of the political dimension. So, you know, we're economists and we work in the public sector and we're trying to make the world a better place. And so when we see things like programmability, we think, well, great, we could do all kinds of great things. You know, we could, you know, targeted monetary policy, we could do, you know, all kinds of things. But then when this idea got conveyed to the public, it didn't come across that way. It came across as government control. And it, quite interestingly, there was an incident in Canada. I'm Canadian, by the way. I haven't said about yet or anything, so maybe you didn't pick it up. But in Canada, there was this protest around COVID about truckers. And so what happened was the truckers started doing, I don't know, blockades, but a big convoy of trucks all descended on Ottawa. And this was causing a lot of disruption. And so the government at the time basically started to take actions to confiscate or to freeze the bank accounts of truckers, not only truckers, but people who had donated to the truckers. This became very scary to people because this wasn't done through courts. This was done in some sense unilaterally by the government. And so this was, I think, a big tipping point in Canada where they said, okay, well, wait a minute. If the government is can do that, then we don't want to have them having more control in some sense over our money. And so I think that really changed things in Canada, and the pendulum sort of swung away from this idea of a favorable attitude towards, although to be fair, you know, most people didn't even understand what the difference was between, say, central bank money and commercial bank money. And so there was always this sort of idea that much of the discussions that are surrounding CBDC were sort of autotelic, right? They were just going on by central bankers amongst themselves. But these are all the kind of events that started to happen. And if you think about the United States, for example, I mean, we went from the Central Bank Money for All Act to the CBDC Surveillance Act, like a 100% pivot in attitudes. And so, yeah, the idea of retail CBDC, it wasn't flying politically. And so virtually all the countries that started to move in that direction, and in some ways, quite naturally, the government provides money. If all payments are becoming digital, why wouldn't you provide a digital option. So you could almost see it as almost the default position to take steps in that direction. But yeah, as you mentioned, most of the countries have moved away. Now, the exception, as you said, would be the Eurozone. And I think the Eurozone has, you know, distinct reasons, you know, for wanting to pursue the digital euro. I think there's this belief that, you know, they don't want to be dependent on external systems. They believe there's some sense in which it can strengthen the union. These are fine reasons. But what I, you know, when I look at it and I see the way the design is progressing, you know, I see it a little bit as like a missed opportunity. And what I mean by that is that, as I alluded to a few minutes ago, much of the work that I've done in this area has to do with privacy. And, you know, when I think about the central bank and the provision of money, one thing that they've done in the past is they provided a private way to pay, that is through cash. But as payments become largely digital, like, for example, I don't believe I can pay on Amazon Prime using cash, you lose that privacy. And so there becomes the question, should the central government continue to provide this private way to pay? As I said, I could argue that it's maintaining the status quo, you know, as opposed to something different or new. And so, you know, the way the digital euro looks to me that it's designed, although others may know more, the central bank digital currency is not, there's no relationship between the consumer and the central bank. It's done through the payment service provider. So once that's true, then there's no more privacy than there is in conventional payment methods. And so, you know, once you mix in the fact that it can't pay interest and there are limits on holdings and other constraints, merchants can't hold it, then all of a sudden it's not so clear to me what it's adding. Conceptually, I think the idea of a digital euro, again, let me restate. I see the other arguments that I mentioned at the very beginning, and those are perfectly reasonable. But on the dimension I just mentioned, namely privacy, I think it's a missed opportunity as it currently stands.
And privacy and potentially offline payments could also be the reason for a public authority or a public institution to enter a market which is predominantly driven where services are provided by the private sector, right? That's another question that I would have. Why does the public institution of a central bank actually have to intervene in this market? Is there a market failure, right? And especially if the features that you have also alluded to, which is privacy in regular online payments, because yeah, the digital euro shall be very private on an offline variant that is also apparently going to be developed. But in the online variant, it's as you say, I also see it, regular form of money, right? Regular form of payment, where ultimately the intermediary has to also ensure regulatory compliance and AFC and AML compliance.
Yeah. Yeah, and let me emphasize that when I say privacy, I mean transactional privacy. I don't mean full anonymity. And I do mean that this has to be done in a way that protects the public.
Interesting. Maybe let's come back to from Fedcoin to Catcoin, so on the wholesale side, right? Which use cases do you predominantly see for wholesale CBDC and where you've also focused on? Because there's various different ways to look at it, right? From a capital markets perspective, for settlement of securities, for example, there's been lots of development on the tokenized security side. Last year, the ECB has also done their test transactions where many of those tokenized securities were settled in central bank money. Or is it rather payments? Because this is also another potential angle, and I'm quite sure we will also touch on that in the next minutes as well when it comes to payment settlement, right? But what's your view? Where is the predominant focus and also benefit beyond settling via existing RTGS systems, for example?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's a settlement asset, right? It's if you look at the principles for financial market infrastructures, the idea is that you want to settle in central bank where settle in central bank money where possible. And this is actually the easiest argument in favor of CBDC, by the way, which is that if commercial banks are going to start to utilize some type of tokenized deposit or stablecoin for that matter, and if you want to settle these transactions, then the central bank has to provide, well, it doesn't have to, but it's reasonable to say that the central bank should provide a comparable settlement asset, a tokenized settlement asset. And I said doesn't have to because I'm aware of the idea of these trigger solutions where one of the asset exists. This is from the Bundesbank, and I believe. So it's possible to have one of the assets be tokenized and then have some type of communication between the DLT platform and conventional systems that can trigger, say, settlement and central bank money off of the DLT platform. So that's a perfectly reasonable idea. But if you want to have, what they would call full composability, then there are some advantages if you can put the central bank money in the same form as the tokenized commercial bank money. So that's the case. I mean, it's a very simple argument. The banks provide the settlement asset. If the commercial banks are using tokenized money, then the central bank should provide tokenized money. I think that's the basic argument. And then in terms of, what are the actual immediate use cases? Well, one of the things that's also interesting when we look at the way the discussion of, say, retail CBDC evolved is that it's a lot of focus on the consumer. Does the consumer want this? And so on. Does the consumer understand the difference? Would the consumer benefit from having some type of tokenized central bank money? But the reality is the vast majority of payments, are not person-to-person payments, but they're business-to-business payments. And so, when we really think about, leveraging technology to improve payment systems, it is natural to think about those types of use cases, as you alluded to. And one of those is corporate payments. And I do think there's a huge benefit to corporate payments, to having, money that can be transferred over programmable platforms, because cash management is complex. And there are significant benefits from improvements in transparency and speed. So, cash managers use, especially in very large corporations, they use treasury management systems that do flow tracking and liquidity management and reconciliation. And much of this can be done perhaps in a better way using distributed ledger systems. So that's a very natural application and first use case. And of course, remember, as long as you believe there are some good use cases to start with, and it's worth building something. And then, of course, as we've seen from many, many different applications over the years, that once you built it, new use cases emerge. So I would expect things would grow drastically from there. But the key is to get these infrastructures in place to begin with.
Yeah, I mean, looking back what we've covered so far, 2017 or 2013 at the Fed, 2017, then the first papers on it, 2020 Libra. And then I think 2021, the paper from Tony McLaughlin on the regulated liability network came out, which sparked lots of interest and created lots of interest, which then led to a couple of pilot transactions in the UK, in the US, under different names. But in general, the same philosophy was always at the ground, which is basically having tokenized deposits, so representation of bank account money or bank money, commercial bank money, tokenized on a platform, but then also to settle those, right? Because the idea was to stick to account-based money. We're going to come back on the difference to account-based versus bearer instruments in a minute, also when we talk about stablecoins. But here it was still introduced to rely on or stick to the account-based nature of bank accounts and tokenized deposits. And then clearly a settlement needs to take place, right? And that were ultimately then also led to Project Agora, which is currently also happening at the BIS, or which is developing, let's put it this way, right? So maybe give us an overview, and also from your view, why there was such an interest in, applying this two-tiered monetary system with deposits and central bank money now for regular payments use cases, as you said, for B2B use cases, for example, and where you see the major benefits of really using tokens instead of regular bank account systems that run on other technology.
Yeah, so I mean, these are the benefits that have just been, articulated for years. The idea of, programmability 24/7, these types of things. And so, I would point out that the interest in this really came from the private sector, from the commercial banks. They started talking about tokenized deposits. Well, I mean, actually, there was I wrote a paper a while ago with a few colleagues of the at the New York Fed with Michael Lee and Antoine Martin and Joe Terragrossa, which was called "The Future of Payments is Not Stablecoins." But I can defend that title if asked, and my current position. But that's what we've said back then was just basically that if you want to leverage the benefits of distributed ledger platforms, the benefits of tokenization, you don't need a new money. We have deposits. So just tokenize the deposits. That was always said in that article. Even today, I think that's true to some extent, that I do have a favorable position towards the concept of a stable coin, but it doesn't mean that they're better than the idea of using a tokenized deposit. So, I wrote this article with Hyun Shin called Stablecoins versus Tokenized Deposits, Implications for the Singleness of Money. And, in that article, we were really sort of talking about these two ways of doing it, right? The one is the idea of a tokenized deposit, which, as you said, would follow a conventional process whereby liabilities aren't transferred. When I pay you, you don't suddenly have a liability of my bank. That's just not how we do it. And there are lots of reasons for that. Instead, what a payment really is a payment instruction, which updates a liability structure. So the liability at my bank goes down, the liability at your bank goes up. And why would your bank suddenly introduce a liability to you? Well, because your bank gets paid in central bank money. That's the way the system works. And so RLN, for example, and to some extent myself and others were arguing is well, you can do that with deposit. You can do that with a deposit model. And that seems like a sensible way to do it. And in that article, we made some arguments for that. So one was the idea of, preserving KYC boundaries and not having to worry about price depegs, because, when you do a payment in the conventional world, you get a dollar. This is as much a market outcome as it is an institutional outcome. That's just the way the payment system works. And so, in order to sort of keep things simple, I guess the way they currently were, we were advocating that. But, things, and there are also other issues, by the way, that if your deposit token can circulate, like as become a bearer instrument, then suddenly a bank doesn't really know who its depositors are, or even if it knows, it doesn't necessarily control who they are or know their characteristics. So it, has to worry about uncertainty with respect to deposit with withdrawals and things like that. But look, a lot has changed since then. And so, we have new technologies for using approved lists. We have concepts of shared ledgers. And then Ubix, of course, came along. And so I'm an advisor to Ubix that solves depegging problem by introducing a clearing system. And, what I find really interesting about that is that once you start clearing, then, and I think you've had Tony on before, and I'm sure he said that then stablecoins take on an interpretation as basically like digital checks. Again, they're really just payment instructions. A stablecoin is not a private competing currency. It's a payment instruction that's still at the end of the day instructing movement of money that's on conventional balance sheets. In this case, the balance sheet of the issuer, but it's still pointing to a traditional balance sheet. And all that's really happening when we move from, say, like a conventional wire transfer to a sort of a stable coin payment that goes through a clearing system, is we're just moving from a push payment to a pull payment. That's all that's really happening. And if it clears right away, then they're almost identical. But the difference with, say, the stablecoin payment is you don't have to pull it right away. In fact, not only do you not have to pull it, but you might transfer it to somebody else and have them pull it. But ultimately, that's the real difference. I see a lot of potential in the development of these ideas. I'm very bullish on the idea of commercial banks issuing their own stablecoins to facilitate payments for customers, but not in the same sense that you're seeing, say, Tether and Circle operate on like in decentralized finance, but rather as something that's really quite boring, just an alternative way to send a payment instruction. But it's a very nice way, right? Because, you know, if you want to do a cross-border payment, for example, it's one global infrastructure. You don't have to deal with different time zones and different rule sets and so on. But at the end of the day, you're just sending a pull payment instruction. That's all it is. And so what I would like to see in the future is that stablecoins become very boring. because when something's boring, that means it's successful. When you stop talking about it, it's successful. I mean, this is the nature of payments, as you know. I mean, payments is called the plumbing of the financial system because it's you know, when it's working, you don't care about it. But when it's not working, it's your biggest problem. And so, like I said, I think the future that I want to see is that all of the commercial banks issue stablecoins, but they're really issuing them in the form of digital checks. In many instances, you would expect to see them cash right away. They just go through the clearing system and money would appear in a conventional account because, you know, if they're not paying interest or, you know, then that's just what would happen, at least in the initial stages. And I just want to make one more quick advantage to that, which is that if stablecoins were used by the traditional sector in this way, and again, I'm really focusing on the traditional financial sector's use of stable coins. You know, you could also, by the way, call them deposit tokens at that point. I don't know why they should have to be fully backed. That doesn't make sense to me, given that banks can issue deposits on a fractional basis. So I would like to see that banks could issue these so-called stable coins against the strength of their balance sheet. But, you know, if we get to that world, then one of the really cool things, I think, is that we reduce sort of financial stability risk and systemic risk, because there's no reason why we'd have massive stocks of stablecoins at this point. These stablecoins would be created, used as a payment instruction, and then they would be redeemed. And so we could have very, very high values and volumes in terms of transactions, but we wouldn't have these massive stocks tying up huge amounts of liquidity. So that's the future that I see.
Yeah, very interesting. Now, we started with the Project Agora or tokenized deposits, where it's rather a push payment that needs to be settled in central bank money and then jump directly into stablecoins. Let me, if I may, come back real quick on tokenized deposits again, where we currently stand and your view on what will be the development on the push payment before we then come back and double click again on the pull payment on stablecoins. Because I think that's precisely the difference, right? Where you have a bearer instrument like asset, which is a liability of one institution that has issued it, that can be held basically technically by everybody that is not on the blacklist of the issuer. Whereas account-based money is very different, right? Which has a whitelist approach, only those clients that or those citizens or entities that are clients of the issuer can actually hold those accounts. And this is so far also true for the tokenized deposit solutions that are around, right? Which are also somewhat different than the end goal that you also already discussed, where central bank money can be used and eventually everything is on the shared ledger, on the same ledger. Because the solutions that we so far have is, you know, we can name them, right? Kinexys from JP Morgan, Citi Token Service. It's rather a bank-centric network where interoperability to other banks is very challenging, right? Because you are bound within the ecosystem of that particular bank. So how would you rate the existing solutions when it comes to the end goal, which might be Project Agora, which has more like a unified ledger as a concept where commercial banks and central banks jointly issue the money? And is that now a dead concept because you favor rather the pull payment, the stable coins, or where does this whole account-based tokenized deposit industry and developments currently stand, and where do you see
on the next? Project Agora is a dead project at all. I think it's you know, that's a fantastic project, and it's trying to do something very specific. It's trying to test whether or not correspondent banking can be improved using distributed ledger technologies. That's a very well-defined experiment. And there are lots of good reasons to think why it would. These have been articulated, of course, by the people that are currently running the project. I was involved in the project when I was at the BIS. But, you know, you're taking this sequential process that can possibly have errors occurring, and then you need to unwind, and you can make it simultaneous. And so just all kinds of things you can do through programmability. That's a very good concept. It's well worth testing. And I think the you know, the distinction that, or what's interesting to discuss in that regard is that, well, when that project was initiated, the banks were not allowed to participate, or it didn't seem to be foreseeable that banks were going to be suddenly allowed to participate on public blockchains. And so they were going to have to do things on this, you know, permissioned infrastructure. And it's natural to try and implement those types of payments in a way that the banks are currently comfortable with and familiar with. But then all of a sudden, you know, the rules changed. At least the regulatory landscape changed after Trump was elected and the Genius Act. And all of a sudden, the door is open potentially for banks to participate on public blockchains. So the question then becomes, you know, do you build your own, like to use an analogy, do you build your own private golf course where you, you know, build the holes the way you want them and only the people are allowed on the course that you want, or do you use the public course? And so, you know, where there might be some people on the course you don't like, but, you know, you deal with it. That's kind of the choice that banks face. And it's not clear to me. You know, I think both aspects are well worth exploring. Remember, what the legislation did is there used to be a no swimming sign, right? So for public blockchains. And that sign was replaced with a sign that says swim at your own risk. So the legislation doesn't remove the requirements for anti-money laundering or sanctions compliance. It doesn't remove these restrictions from banks. It just says, if you can figure out a way to meet these requirements, then you're free to go ahead and try. But this is a tough one. If you go back to the reasons why correspondent banking needed improving, that is, you know, we have the reduction in correspondent banking chains and the reduction in the number of correspondents, it's because of costs and increased risks. And these risks are a big one. I mean, the fines that are assigned to banks, as you know, are in the billions and can sometimes cause banks to almost go under. And so, you know, this is a big deal. And so, you know, where we're at now is, can banks leverage this technology in a way that they meet regulatory requirements? Can they best do that in a system that they fully control? Or can they figure out a way to do this on public blockchain? And so I don't know the answer to that. You know, there's lots of, and there are other requirements too, like privacy. So, you know, public blockchains don't provide the privacy that's needed or didn't, but there are new, the Canton Network, there are new initiatives out there that are really making advances. It's quite interesting if you think, go back all the way to go full circle. You know, we started off talking about Jasper. The first leg of Jasper was done on Ethereum. And we're like, well, no, we can't really do this on Ethereum. Everything's public. But a lot has changed since then. And so, like I said, it's not up to me to decide. It's up to the commercial banks. And this is what I think, you know, they're doing. They're trying to figure out, you know, how they can operate on these public blockchains and still meet all their user and regulatory requirements. And maybe that means, you know, doing the moving the commercial bank money on the public blockchain and triggering settlement in central bank money off chain. There are lots of ways to do this, and you know, really smart people are working really hard on this, and it's hard to keep up. But you know, so it's not an either or. You know, I think it's well worth exploring, you know, the different alternatives.
And two different ways to move money in a digital form, right? What I really like the paper. It's a very short article, and we're gonna put all the articles that you wrote in the show notes. There's a nice overview site from the BIS with all of your papers. What's this next generation correspondent banking? I really like that. It's very short and crisp, basically explaining how correspondent banking works, what the problems currently are with the decline in correspondent banks, and then also how tokenization could help. It goes hand in hand, I would say, with this other paper, The Tokenization Continuum, where also you provided the overview of what tokenization could lead to and which benefit exists. Even in an account-based model where you would push the payments, right, that would ultimately be settled between different settlement banks providing the same currency and central bank money, which is obviously complex, right? Because you need to have multiple banks and even the central banks on the shared ledger. So I think also that this is an extraordinary project that is currently running with Project Agora, with 7 central banks, with more than 40 payment institutions, really trying to reinvent how cross-border payments can work or will work. So very, very interesting. However, then as you said, also the shift to public ledgers or public distributed ledgers, public blockchains, also make it possible to go into this completely different way of moving funds, which is more this bearer-like asset, right? Because ultimately everybody in theory in this world can access this public ledger, which is not necessarily true for private ledgers, right? You would usually have controls, and therefore you can eventually allow different banks to hold different bank coins or bank tokens, however you want to call it, but not necessarily your citizens if they don't even have access to this private network, right? So I think that also corresponds to the development of public versus private ledgers when it comes to the type of asset or the money that can be used. So now coming back full circle, as you say, to stablecoins, right? You mentioned already that you are working on with Tony McLaughlin on this new endeavor, Ubix, and I really enjoyed the podcast with him as well, because he's such an interesting character, also coming from this account-based model and traditional banking, now completely switching to stablecoins, and basically saying it is a big benefit to have money being moved as a bearer instrument, especially for cross-border. You already talked a lot about it. That was quite interesting. My question would be on the pull payment, right? If then the stablecoin is received from another bank, for example, that shall, and this is the concept of Ubix, right, that shall allow the off-ramping as well into account-based money in that particular balance sheet of the bank. Isn't it somewhat similar to a payments expert, right? So to a 103 and 202 equivalent, right? So to a covered payment. And what is that? Ultimately, when the payment advice is already sent, but you still have to wait for the settlement, right? Would the bank actually credit before the settlement takes place? This is something that I so far haven't really gotten my head around, right? Because ultimately, if it's only, as you already said, right, if it's only a claim on the money, right, which you can then pull, would the recipient ultimately already get them funds before the settlement takes place, right? Because this is ultimately the idea of speeding up the settlement of money across borders.
Yeah. This is a question about the specific operation of the Ubix clearing system, which I can't comment at the moment. You used the term moving funds, but really we're never moving funds. That's the right. I mean, you know this, of course, but we're never really moving funds. What we're doing is updating liability structures. Money doesn't actually move because ultimately a stablecoin is still just pointing to value on a traditional balance sheet. And so it is just a check. It is just a digital check. Now, you know, again, digital checks are typically written on customer accounts, and stablecoins are written on the issuer account. But fine, it's still a digital check. It's a negotiable instrument, and so we have to figure out how we're going to handle the processing of these checks. And the default would be to handle it exactly from a regulatory perspective, would be to handle it the exact same way that we do with conventional checks, with UCC Articles 3 and 4. UCC 3 defines a negotiable instrument, and UCC 4 defines rules surrounding bank deposits and collections. And so you know, this is what we need. And like I said, this is what we need for them to become boring. When a bank uses a stablecoin or a customer uses a stablecoin to initiate a payment, the clearing system has to decide if there's available funds. If there's available funds, it puts that through. If there isn't, it rejects it. So notice it puts it through at full value or it rejects it. So we maintain singleness. A payment is always goes through a dollar. There's never a chance the payment goes through at 98 cents on the dollar. It goes through dollar for dollar. That's the basic idea. I mean, I think it's really important to try and sort of, in some ways, you know, detach yourself from the thinking of how stablecoins are used in DeFi and in sort of the blockchain world, and focus on instead, you know, how the traditional financial sector might use them. And they're not competing against Tether and Circle, but rather they're just utilizing this technology. It's really more about the rails, by the way, than it is anything else. Because again, you know, what do you call it if a commercial bank wants to allow a customer to send a payment instruction in the form of, say, a deposit token? Well, if that deposit token is allowed to circulate as a bearer instrument, is it a stable coin? Well, I guess, but that's not really the relevant issue. You know, the relevant issues are, you know, how can it travel? Like, does it, so if it doesn't have to be cashed right away, maybe that's different. Although, as you probably well know, I can write you a check and you can sign that check over to someone else. Right. And then they can deposit that check. So, you know, nothing new under the sun. Right. I mean, it's really just a digital version of what we do with checks. And so I think we would treat them exactly the way we treat checks. I think it's actually quite simple.
And would you, so a couple of minutes back, you also said the deposit token concept of having bearer instruments also has its difficulties for bank integration, for example, right? The bank wouldn't know who the holders are. And in your paper, stablecoin versus tokenized deposits, you also said there's KYC issues, there's eventually price depegs and so forth. Wouldn't the same issue then not occur when you have stablecoins issued by banks that are also backed by the variety of assets that is on this balance sheet and not necessarily a segregation of funds that are risk-free?
It is an issue if these deposit tokens / stablecoins, whatever you want to call them, if they're allowed to circulate without being enacted upon immediately. Like I said, even with a paper check, you can use it as a bearer instrument. So again, this is nothing new, but again, in a digital world, I understand because these things can circulate so freely and maybe be held for long periods of time. And so, yes, you have to deal with these issues. But like I said, like, so the KYC issue, how do you deal with that? Well, again, you can have approved lists. And these tokens can only circulate amongst members of people that are approved. People have talked about shared ledgers. So there are ways to deal with this and allow these coins to circulate. But then you get back to this question of settlement. So now, what does it mean for a payment to settle? So if I pay you with a deposit token and you just hold the deposit token, or maybe your bank holds the deposit token and credit to your account, well, then now the bank is holding a claim on the other bank. So, you know, in a way, we're sort of drifting back into almost a deferred net settlement system, right? And of course, we got away from deferred net settlement precisely to avoid these cross-bank credit exposures. But like I said before, things have changed, right? Technology is different. And, you know, I like to call it, some of the concepts that like JP Morgan and so on are exploring, I like to call it like fine-tuned DNS. Because, you know, one of the reasons that DNS was unviable is because you just couldn't keep track of the exposures. You just didn't know what the exposures were intraday and so on. Well, now all of a sudden, if these exposures are being tracked on a blockchain, then you have real-time visibility. And these can be managed and you can start to clear exposures intraday. So it just becomes a different thing. In some ways, the reasons why we got rid of the deferred net settlement in the first place might not be as binding today. So, you know, so yes, there are differences, but I just don't see any of this as being that complicated. Once we drill down what these instruments really are and what they're trying to do, they're just doing things that we've been doing all along with a different technology. And sometimes the technology matters. Like I just said, it matters here because suddenly I do think, you know, having deferred net settlement becomes viable again. And so it does change things, but it shouldn't be so complicated.
Yeah, and new technologies also allow new ways to manage payments and manage visibility of those risks in the system. That is a big benefit, I think, as well, right? Looking at the time has run very quickly, almost an hour already. Maybe as a last question, Rod, before we wrap up after all these interesting insights and the good discussion, we've now positioned, at least as a takeaway that I would see it, how I would see it, rather those two competing ways to move money, right? And you, I really like the example of a push and a pull, right? Because the push is really similar to how we move money today in correspondent banking, similar ways, but using new technology and hopefully make it more efficient. And then pull is really, you get the claim on the underlying reserve, similar to a check, and then you pull the funds into your account, right? Where do you see both projects when it comes to collaboration, or is it a completely separate way to move money? Do they compete? What's your view on that?
Well, I'm going to give a fairly soft answer, which is that it's just not an either or, right? Mm-hmm. So we use both systems today. Paper checks became pretty cumbersome even when they were digitized. And so they were kind of phased out. But these new types of digital checks might have advantages. It all just comes down to when the payee and the payer see it advantageous to use a push and when they see it advantageous to use a pull. But it doesn't have to be either or. It's going to depend on the use case.
Yeah, and coming back to my analogy of 103s and 202s, so the cover and pay scenario, maybe there's even a combination, right? So the stablecoin would be the 103, it is received very quickly, and then the 202 is actually settled via Agora, so ultimately also moving the underlying funds very quickly to the respective bank that shall credit the accounts, the funds in the account, right? On that note, I think that's a perfect summary of how these developments might go into the same direction. Rod, thanks a lot for all these insights. That was fantastic discussion. I appreciate a lot your time and insights. Anything at the end you want to get away into our listeners' ears again?
No. I think we covered everything. And again, I just appreciate the opportunity to speak with you today about these topics.
Very good. Now, dear listeners, I hope this was interesting. I hope you like it. If you like it, give us a like on social media, share the episode and also the podcast with your friends and colleagues that might be interested in that. That is always highly appreciated. And make sure you follow us for the next interesting episodes. And yeah, Rod, maybe we'll invite you again in a couple of months or years to look back again over the last years then, where I think there's lots of developments in the next years to come. Yeah.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
The views expressed are solely the personal opinions of the hosts and are provided for informational purposes only. This podcast does not offer financial or investment advice. Always conduct your own research and make well-informed decisions before investing. Please be aware that the hosts and guests may hold cryptocurrencies or digital assets discussed in this episode.